Induction of labor is an increasingly more and more common birth intervention that many women experience today. There are several medically indicated reasons for induction, as well as many situations where women may be offered or even coerced into induction, where there isn't the beneficial evidence to back it up. This week on the podcast, I got to interview Dr. Rebecca Decker of the very well-known blog and podcast called Evidence-Based Birth, all about the various aspects of labor induction. We discuss the ARRIVE trial, big babies, risks for postpartum hemorrhage, the evidence on eating and drinking, and more. I hope that you find this educational and enjoyable. Let's go.
Welcome to Healthy as a Mother, the podcast for becoming and being a mother, with your co-hosts, Dr. Leah Gordon and Dr. Morgan McDermott, two naturopathic doctors who get it.
Each week, we teach you how to be the healthiest mother you can be, from fertility and preconception to pregnancy and birth prep, through postpartum and throughout motherhood, empowering you with the natural health guidance and education you're not getting elsewhere, so you can confidently navigate the broken system at large.
The real, the raw, the untalked about. And remember, this information is not intended to diagnose, treat, or manage any disease. Always consult with your doctor before making any changes.
Staying truly deeply hydrated with minerals while trying to conceive, during pregnancy and birth, and throughout your breastfeeding journey is very important. And nowadays, there are more options for this than we can even count. For Dr. Leah and I, ingredient quality is of top concern, and that's why we love Relight electrolyte powders by Redmond Real Salt. Relight contains Redmond's ancient unrefined sea salt, which contains 60 plus trace minerals in and of itself. Relight powders conveniently contain the appropriate proportions and forms of calcium, potassium, chloride, and even two forms of magnesium, malate and glycinate. It tastes amazing, and my favorite flavor is strawberry lemonade. Use code HEALTHYMOTHER for 15% off your order of any of the other products that Redmond has to offer, including their OG sea salt, other seasoning salts, natural toothpaste, bentonite clays, and more. Happy hydrating. Okay, so this episode of the podcast is a really big deal for me because we have a really special guest on, Rebecca Decker. I am like kind of fangirling, and I think that it is so it's a testament to my career, I guess, that I get to talk to you at this point. I'm like, this means I've made it. Because I have been following your work for the entirety of my entire motherhood journey. And so for those who don't know, I want to read your bio and get them really excited about it. And then we're going to talk today about induction and a couple of different sort of conversational points about induction. It's not going to necessarily be a very thorough, here's every single thing, induction 101, but we're going to talk about some of these points that I think people hear about a lot of, well, and then maybe just offering a different perspective and also just looking at the evidence. What is happening with some of these numbers when we are inducing women for, you know, labor? So first off, let me just read your bio here. So Rebecca Decker, a nurse and PhD, is the founder and CEO of Evidence-Based Birth. I can almost guarantee most of our audience, if not all of them, have heard of evidence-based birth, as with like the rest of the birth world and anybody who's interested in anything to do with this type of work, because you are really like the guiding light, the lighthouse at the edge of the sea, you know, of look at all of this information and look at it objectively. And what does that mean now? I love the way you write your articles. They're so accessible for so many people. And I also very much trust you. I think that you are doing such a good job. I know that's like probably a lot of pressure for you to feel, but it's such a beautiful work and life and job that you have. So anyways, you're also the author of Babies Are Not Pizzas. They're Born, Not Delivered. Love that title so much. Previously, Dr. Decker was an assistant professor of nursing at the University of Kentucky, and in 2016, she's shifted gears to focus full-time on the mission of evidence-based birth. Dr. Decker and the team at Evidence-Based Birth are committed to creating a world in which all families have access to safe, respectful, evidence-based, and empowering care during pregnancy, birth, and postpartum. Woohoo to that. Evidence-Based Birth does this by boldly making the research evidence on childbirth freely and publicly accessible. Dr. Decker is also the host of Evidence-Based Birth podcast with more than 5.5 million downloads. So yeah, we will link your website, your podcast, your social media in all different forms, any specific articles that we talk about or any specific podcast episodes. I love listening to your podcast. I think that it's one of those things that in my ideal world, when women go on walks, when they're pregnant, they're listening to a combination of the evidence-based birth podcast and birth stories to really just pack their subconscious and learn and keep up on all of this information. So welcome to the show. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to talk with you.
Yeah, this is a really hot button item, topic item, you know, this idea of induction. So just a really quick overview for people that don't know what I'm saying, or to just I guess give a one single definition here. Induction is the idea of inducing or putting a woman into labor to have her baby. So there's different methods of doing that. In the United States, the more common option would probably be the use of a synthetic oxytocin called Pitocin. In other parts of the world, sometimes it's called Syntocin. And there's other things that we can do. We can use like a prostaglandin form with pills or gels, like a misoprostol, misoprostone. We can use a Foley bulb. There are more gentle versions of induction, but still arguably the goal would be to get the baby to come out. Not necessarily always does it work, but something like membrane stripping. Back in the day, they used to also use breaking of water as like a main form of induction, but that's not really seen as much anymore. There's a lot of benefits to the baby keeping their waters intact, so that amniotic sac fluid. So there's things that have shifted and changed over time, of course. And I think that my goal with this conversation is to highlight some of these really common reasons that aren't necessarily totally medically. It's not like, okay, we have a baby that is not growing anymore. So something like intrauterine growth restriction, so or sometimes called IUGR, or there's other names for it, but basically where the baby should be born because they're not doing that well inside anymore. They need to come on the outside and get more nutrition that way. That's a very legitimate use of induction sometimes. Or something like maybe gestational diabetes or preeclampsia or an infection, of course, or you know, some of these other medical things, cholecystitis. So if there's going to be a problem going on with the liver and baby is going to be at risk of, you know, harm or mom at risk of harm too, some of these issues are like, okay, we need to get this baby out now. But then there's a lot that are in this gray area. So going past dates or maybe a suspected big baby. And so I just wanted to kind of lead into that we'll be talking about a lot of different points here. And I wanted to get your sort of general opinion on what do you think, and after all of this research that you've done through all these years, let's just kind of start talking. Where are you at with this?
Okay, so you gave a really good overview, Morgan, but labor induction is a fascinating topic because people have been trying to induce labor for as long as we know. This is not a new subject. There have always been reasons to induce labor. You know, historically, it was used for fetal demise, for rickets, if your pelvis was misshapen and the baby would not be able to fit, for preeclampsia, which they used to call toxemia. And then, of course, like maternal comfort. So some people are just done with being pregnant and they want the baby out. And so, you know, midwives, who were the providers long before obstetricians, have used many herbal remedies throughout thousands of years to try and induce labor. One of the most common herbal remedies was something called ergot, which is a fungus that grew on rye. And eventually there was a backlash against ergot because of the many risks it carries, including the risk of uterine rupture. And you mentioned amniotomy, so breaking the waters was also a common. In the era before antibiotics, though, that could be life-threatening because it could cause infection, and there was no treatment for infections back then. So it was a big advance in the medical field when they realized one of the main components of causing contractions is this hormone called oxytocin, which is produced in the hypothalamus in your brain, released from the posterior pituitary gland. And it's known for its uterine contraction and milk ejecting effects. And it's also known for its impacts on sexual activity, maternal behavior, social bonding, chest warmth, that kind of mama bear feeling that people get when they're trying to protect their children. And these behavioral effects and emotional effects of oxytocin are caused by its central release in the brain, but then it also circulates in the blood. So somebody actually won the Nobel Prize for figuring out how to synthetically make oxytocin. So it's called synthetic oxytocin. The brand name is Pitocin, and that is chemically identical to the oxytocin you release, but it's instead given through the vein. So it doesn't have the effects in your brain. It's just acting in the periphery and in your uterus. So that was a big advance in the field. And it was shortly after that was discovered that we started seeing more inductions being done for convenience or just for the clinician's preference, because like I said earlier, the ways of induction were pretty risky and were only used if the benefits clearly outweighed the risks. But with oxytocin, it suddenly became a lot easier to start labor. And I think that's when you started seeing the elective inductions start becoming more popular in like the 1960s. And then they gradually increased and then just really started a huge increase in the last 20 years or so. And at first, you know, we kind of kept moving the goalposts. It was you get induced at 42 weeks, you know, if you were more than 2 weeks past your due date. And then the randomized trials showed actually 41 weeks is a good point to induce labor because clearly the benefits outweigh the risks at that point. And now you have the ARRIVE trial that came out, and many OBs in the United States, but not necessarily other parts of the world, but mainly in the United States are recommending induction at 39 weeks. So technically that would be an elective induction, meaning there's not a specific medical reason to have an induction. But what I'm hearing from doulas and parents and midwives across the United States is that this, it tends to be framed as more medically necessary, or they might be told you really need to have this induction for your baby's safety or your safety, even though they don't give a clear medical reason. It's kind of vague. And then oftentimes people are surprised afterwards when they find out that it was coded in their insurance as an elective induction. So we're seeing a lot of this shift toward the 39 weeks. And I would say it's probably the number one top issue for birth workers in this country because it's being offered or recommended or sometimes even pressured onto their clients. So that's kind of like a quick, in a nutshell, evolution of induction.
Yeah. Wow. Thank you so much for mentioning all of those historical references too. I love to, I'm an anthropologist by training, and I think that using that lens is key to understanding what is happening today in modern motherhood and all sorts of facets of understanding, you know, where have our advancements been, but also potentially looking at that information as and to inform why are we having different struggles, what's happening, how could this possibly be the way that this is like meant to be, you know, whether that's the lack of the village or the very high cesarean rate, like what is going on? There's so many factors that happen, you know? Mm-hmm. So I appreciate you going back on that. And it's making me think too that I should probably have some sort of conversation about those herbs on here and some of the other things like castor oil, some of the more natural things, because mm-hmm. there is risks to all of that as well. I think that sometimes people think, well, because it's natural, there's going to be no risk. Even membrane stripping, you know, these. So if somebody doesn't know, a membrane strip is where a finger or two is inserted up into the cervix. You have to be slightly dilated at least for it to happen. Otherwise, they cannot do it. And this is prior to you having your baby. They're going to go in inside in between the amniotic sac and the cervical tissue, and they sort of sweep any of these little adhesions or pieces of membrane, that's essentially, you know, and they're going to sweep around and dislodge those. Also, this action of touching the cervix in and of itself releases prostaglandins, and this can be something to tip somebody into labor. It can also accidentally break the amniotic sac, accidentally introduce infection, cause kind of erratic contraction patterns that can exhaust a woman, just sort of poke and prod when we're not really ready. So there are negative effects, but I feel like sometimes those things are never talked about. Similarly with castor oil. Castor oil can sometimes really get contractions going, but can also dehydrate women. It can stress out babies. There's, you know, there's all these back and forth. One thing about Pitocin, I think, is that sometimes people have this misconception that, oh, well, if it's the exact same chemical as oxytocin, then there could be no downsides to it. And it's like, well, yes, chemically, but as you mentioned, very important part is that it does not cross the blood-brain barrier. And so there are not these brain effects. And so it's not going to behave exactly the same in the body. It's given through an IV. It is not your own endogenous contraction pattern and contraction strength. And so women who have had Pitocin-induced contractions will often report, this is a very common thing, that they are stronger, more intense, you know, more painful. There's often a correlation between having a Pitocin induction or a Pitocin augmentation. So that may be that the woman goes into natural spontaneous labor and is having her own contractions, but then it's just potentially taking too long, or maybe there has been water broken and now we're like, what's going on. These, you know, the early labor phase has taken a very long time, or even the active labor phase. And so then they want to augment the labor, just meaning they want to change it. And so then they introduce Pitocin for that reason. So any of these situations where we're using Pitocin, often there is at some point a use of epidural as well. So these things go together frequently, not always, but there is still this idea, this cascade of interventions. And I wanted you to speak to that too, of the what's the evidence around the use of induction and some of these other interventions that sort of come to fruition from that, whether that be complications like postpartum hemorrhage, use of forceps, cesarean, et cetera, anything like that.
Mm-hmm. So good question. With in terms of interventions, I think one thing I didn't mention earlier is as our knowledge has progressed, so have kind of the protocols for induction. So it used to be, yeah, they would just plug in the Pitocin and you'd be on your way. But what they found is a very high rate of cesareans with that, because some people, their cervix was not ready to contract. And so it was not what we call ripe. So now we know before you do Pitocin, you need to get the cervix ready. And so that is a whole another bundle of interventions that you might experience. One of them is probably going to be cervical exams, which can be uncomfortable and even painful for some people, or people who are survivors of sexual violence. They may also find that triggering. So there can be a lot of exams involved with an induction. And not only exams, but procedures, like you mentioned, in the cervix. Some of them could be more gentle. Some of them are going to be more painful. And so there's that whole aspect of preparing the cervix and then the induction itself with starting contractions. And so some of the, what I would think of them, I don't necessarily like to use the word cascade because it feels like, I don't know, scary. So many people have kind of demonized that phrase to make you afraid of medical interventions. But you can think of it as a bundle of things that kind of go together. If you're going to be having Pitocin, it is higher risk because it's not your own endogenous released oxytocin. So your own body is not controlling the release. It's kind of being externally given to you. So because of that, they have to monitor your contractions. They have to monitor the baby's heart tone. So that's typically with a continuous electronic fetal monitor, which for many people means restrictions on your mobility. Many hospitals, obviously it means you're going to have an IV. So you're going to be hooked up to an IV and tubing and a bag and a pump. And
really quick, I wanted to just say for people who don't know this part too, continuous fetal monitoring, continuous electronic fetal monitoring is like those classic kind of pink and blue bands that you'll see that are on the woman's belly. And they are in some instances used for like 20 minutes of every hour. That would be something called like intermittent auscultation or intermittent fetal monitoring. When you are given certain medications during labor, whether that's Pitocin and epidural, whatever, there are protocols now in place where they need to be listening to the baby the whole entire time. So you'd have those on you and they are attached. There's like big long cords that are attached to other things. And so then yes, with the IV as well, you are attached to now a pole. And so that's what she means by this idea of you aren't able to like fully unrestrictedly, maybe between every contraction that you're like on the floor, then you're in a squat and then you're up and you're moving. And so these kinds of little restrictions are, they can be kind of bothersome over time. And it kind of ties you to a little bit of a different spot. And so sometimes people, or you also then you can't be in water. And so there's just a little bit of like, if the world of possibility was infinite with what could happen now, that's like, we have less options for the way that that's going. Again, sometimes we need to do this, you guys, and there's a time and a place for everything. We just want you to understand so that in case that this is happening, you're not like shocked or that you didn't know that that was going to happen, because you have to imagine for a provider in these really fast appointments, they just simply do not have time to explain everything. I do think that they should. We should have a different model where we're getting this information into the hands of people in every situation where there's going to be some kind of a medical intervention. We need to have all the pros, cons, risks, and understanding of what the reality for the woman is actually going to be. And that's why you're listening to this podcast, because you will get the information somehow else. It will not be usually in the moment. And so this is part of this, just the prenatal education. So thank you for saying that. So yes, you'll be more restricted because of the continuous electronic fetal monitoring and having an IV. And sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Go ahead and continue.
Yeah. And I think moving around is possible, but it takes more effort. So it probably require both a doula and a partner to kind of one to support you, one to manage all of the lines and tubing and that sort of thing. One other effect of the monitoring is even if you get wireless monitoring, which is becoming more common, and I definitely encourage our childbirth class students to look for a place that has that, it can still, like, the movement can kind of create some artifact or squiggle lines on the monitor. So that's another reason that sometimes you might be discouraged from moving around a whole lot. It is possible to move. Like I said, it just takes more effort. And then, as you mentioned earlier, with some of these procedures and the contractions generated by the Pitocin can be more painful. So it's often quite common to have an epidural, which then also carries with it continuous oxygen monitoring, as well as frequent blood pressure monitoring and fluids through the IV. So there's a lot. It is, I would consider this a somewhat invasive medical intervention because they're having to approach you from so many different angles and do so many different things to your body. And if this is something you're consenting to and you want it and you're like, I'm ready to have this baby for whatever reason, medical or comfort wise, that's fine. But what we are seeing is more and more providers, you know, saying, let's schedule your induction without any description of what this entails. And one more intervention that I think gets overlooked and people don't know to expect is that fasting from food. So this is an intervention to tell somebody not to eat. And it is quite common in many hospitals that if you're being induced, you're quote unquote not allowed to eat food. Inductions can take anywhere from 24 to 72 hours. I've even heard of some being longer, sometimes being shorter, but in general, that's what I teach people to expect if it's their first baby and they're going in for an induction, including the cervical ripening process, and then the dilation and pushing. So that's a long time to go without food. So something that I talk with clients about is the importance of knowing your human rights and the evidence on eating and drinking in labor, which you can find if you go to evidencebasedbirth.com/eating. So you can know your rights up front and understand that even if there's a policy against eating, that that you are not a prisoner. And even if you were, you cannot withhold food from people. It is not, you know, that's considered a violation of your human rights. So you can eat even if they say you shouldn't. So that is a right of yours. So just something to keep in mind that, you know, when someone's considering an induction, maybe they have one of the medical reasons you were mentioning earlier, Morgan, is to think about, you know, how can I set myself up with enough comfort measures and support to make this a comfortable experience and a positive birth, even though I'm having all of these medical interventions. And like I said, having a doula there with you to help you with your mobility, and then having, you know, bringing your own foods and drinks, whatever you want to use to stay nourished. And then keeping in mind that you might need more comfort measures, or you might be more willing to have an epidural. Maybe you weren't going to have one in the original place, but maybe with an induction, you're like, okay, I'm going to keep an open mind, knowing that these contractions are different than contractions with the spontaneous labor.
Yes. Thank you so much for saying all of that and the bit about eating too, because it is something that people, unless you're very, very, very confident and educated in this world, it can feel like, I say this a lot, and I don't mean this in a negative sense, but there's a power differential when you go into a hospital. You are giving birth to your baby, something that you very much most likely love a lot and want nothing bad to happen to. And there's this power differential that can kind of feel like almost speaking to the police or something, where it's like they're telling you something that you need to do. And you're like, wait a minute, unless I know my rights, like you just said, really, really well, I don't want to, like, well, I don't know, I'm not a doctor, you're the doctor, what's going on? Right. And it's not that they're trying to, well, sometimes I guess that does happen where they are bullying in that kind of a way. But most of the time, they're trying to kind of keep things on a protocol, and there's all these layers. And I feel for the clinicians and the practitioners too, because they have a lot of things to manage. And it doesn't necessarily, right now, the way that it stands, it's not necessarily like the very best for moms and babies as well, and the experience. And so one of my huge things about birth prep is that if we know and understand and can go into it, like you just said, if somebody knows all of the things that could happen, I think that takes out a huge chunk of this feeling taken advantage of or shocked or surprised or traumatized by something that can happen, because they're like, well, is this what I wanted? No. And like, okay, well, this is what's before me now. And we're kind of, there's a pivot in the plan, like on the board game of life, like we're taking a different direction and it's not what I wanted. And at the same time, it's what's necessary or it's happening now. And so I'm going to go down this path. And I knew, at least in the back of my mind, I've heard a couple of times, I've had a few layers of exposure to the idea that there would be monitors on my belly, there would be an IV in my arm, I would be like here for potentially 2 or 3 days. That's one thing that I feel commonly I hear a lot of is people totally shocked about the length of time that it can take. Mm-hmm. And you had mentioned earlier too about priming the cervix. And although we do know that we should do that, I don't see that happening sometimes in practice where the cervix is still, you know, sometimes hard and closed and they will continue with a Pitocin induction. It's like, we're going to be here for a long time, you know, and right. Just understanding that, because I think people will think, oh, I'm going into the hospital, I'm getting induced. And they're like texting their family and they're like, we're going to have a baby tomorrow. And it's like, well, maybe, but it all just know that it could take a long time. And so how are we going to remain? The morale mood wise is good. And also you are comfortable. And yes, like you said, confronting, you may have had a really strong plan against certain pain medication. And it's like, that might change and that's okay. We just need to have had that conversation in our heads so that we're not like, whoa, whoa, whoa. No, I said no, absolutely not to this. And now it's happening before me. And now I feel totally out of control and I feel really unhappy with my whole birth experience. And it's like, we just need to kind of, I think I always tell people, my patients, clients, whoever, to walk through multiple different paths of the way that this birth can go. So, you know, we have our plan A, this is what we want. This is like our top vision. Then we have plan B. Okay, what if things are a little bit different with that, plan C, D, E, F, G, a lot of, and walk through it. And what is your very worst fear? Let's walk through that too, because I think it can just take a little bit of that shock and fear away so that you can be present to this moment that your baby is being born, right? And it's a story that we're going to walk with for the rest of our lives. And hopefully that story can have, you know, the elements of it, of feeling, regardless of how it went, like that we were respected, we were listened to, we had some say in it, or at least we were treated nicely and, you know, whatever, all of that, those components that are important to women. Sometimes those aren't going to be as important to certain people, but certain people are going to hold really, really strongly onto different elements and aspects of it. And I just want them to not feel like if I had like one magic wand thing that I could do with birth, it would just be that people had the information so that they didn't feel like shocked isn't the right word that I'm trying to think of. There's a different word that just maybe like, like when you're
not blindsided, maybe.
Yeah, blindsided. You know, yes, or, exactly. Blindsided. Yeah. Because I feel like that has this word, this other connotation to it where it's like it kind of stops you in your tracks and you're just feeling like, wait, what? And then now all of it goes out of control. That feeling to me is very, mm-hmm. It's like, oh man, that sucks. And I mean, sometimes the most prepared situation, that's also still going to happen. And, you know, sometimes it's life or death. We have to do it. But there is a lot that we can know going into it. I really appreciate all of your points here about this.
Yeah. And then there's also that element of you can prepare for an induction and have the whole plan and it can still, the living through the experience, you know, nothing compares with actual lived experience. And then you may have different opinions and beliefs afterwards. You know, I've known people who've had inductions and it went really smoothly. And they were like, that was way easier than I thought. And then I've had some who were prepared for how hard it would be. And they said, it was worse than I thought, you know, and I never want that again. And so it's everybody's experience is unique as well as their perceptions. And that's why I believe a big part of evidence-based care is your goals, values, and preferences. And what do you want in your care? And sometimes as parents, we just have to learn by living through it. And that can be hard, especially for people who want to have total control or plan everything. So that kind of like letting go. And I don't mean, you know, dropping all expectations, but that kind of release that birth forces you to release and in the moment. That's a hard lesson for some people who want to have like as tight control as possible on life. And I did want to mention one more intervention we kind of mentioned earlier was amniotomy or breaking of the water. And I just wanted to bring up that in first-time moms, randomized trials have found that having Pitocin plus eventually breaking your waters is the most effective way of having a vaginal birth by around 24 hours. So, you know, that we, it is great to keep the waters intact if you can, if you're being induced, and the baby's in a favorable position and every, you know, breaking the waters then releases more prostaglandins and helps the process move. So there is that, is considered actually evidence-based in combination with the Pitocin if it's your first baby. If it's not, if you're having your second, third, or fourth or beyond, it doesn't seem to make a difference in the rates of vaginal birth.
That's interesting. I wonder, is that just because maybe now we're getting more pressure onto the cervix, a first-time cervix that's never dilated?
Yeah, I think it's partly that. And there's also prostaglandins in the amniotic fluid that also help with the process.
Yeah, help with everything happening.
Yeah.
Let's take a quick break to hear a word from our sponsors. Did you know that 97% of women in the U.S. take a prenatal supplement, yet 95% plus are still deficient in key nutrients? My favorite prenatal is from a company called Needed because they dose nutrients at levels to not just meet the bare minimum as most prenatals do. They actually use form of nutrients in dosages that allow mama and baby to thrive. Needed actually approached me years ago and asked me if I could help them design the perfect prenatal because they knew that the current prenatals available were not actually helping women. We spent over 3 years diving into the research and understanding what practitioners are seeing and what women actually need at this important season before we formulated this amazingly supportive option. It's no wonder over 4,000 practitioners now recommend Needed, something I am very proud of. If you have followed me for a while, you know that prenatals and optimizing nutrients starts long before pregnancy, so no matter where you are along your fertility or motherhood journey, Needed is the brand I recommend. Head to thisisneeded.com and use code HEALTHYMOTHER to save 20% on your first order. Again, visit thisisneeded.com and use code HEALTHYMOTHER to save 20%. Okay, back to the show.
Okay, and then this is making me think too that there is another... So can we talk about induction and postpartum hemorrhage? And use of Pitocin, postpartum Pitocin. If we've used Pitocin during labor, then we need to use it during postpartum. Sometimes that's another thing that people are a little bit like, whoa, I didn't know that that was going to happen.
Okay. Yeah. So I've just pulled up, we have an article about Pitocin in the third stage of labor and just all kinds of things about the third stage of labor, which includes, you know, the time after your baby is born. While you're waiting for the placenta to be born is called the third stage of labor. And so if you go to evidencebasedbirth.com/third stage, you can find all the info on that. And in terms of the effects of having an induction on the third stage, if you scroll down, there is a table, table one, it's called factors linked to increased risk of blood loss greater than 1,000 milliliters. So I do want to kind of define what postpartum hemorrhage is because it is confusing and the definitions vary. There's no standard definition because there's some amount of blood loss that is normal and expected after childbirth, but then there's too much, which creates an emergency or can create other bad effects. And where to draw the line between normal and abnormal is controversial. In the starting in the 1950s, it was traditionally defined as losing 500 milliliters of blood, which is about 2 cups of blood within 24 hours. And severe postpartum hemorrhage was defined as losing more than 1,000 milliliters of blood. But now it seems to be redefined. More organizations are defining it as a blood loss of 1,000 milliliters or greater instead of the 500. And it's also difficult to measure blood loss. You know, there's ways you can train providers to estimate, but unless you're weighing what comes out, it's difficult to know for sure how much you've lost. What factors increase the risk of postpartum hemorrhage? Some of these risk factors are things you can know before you go into labor, and others you don't know until you're actually giving birth. But if you've, for example, had 5 or more births in the past, that's considered a moderate risk factor for postpartum hemorrhage. If you have multiples, if you have a first degree relative with a history of postpartum hemorrhage, such as your mother or sister, or if you had high blood pressure during pregnancy, those are what we would consider moderate risk factors that can be identified before labor. The strongest risk factor is having a placenta that covers all or part of the opening of the cervix. It's called placenta previa, or fibroids in your uterus can also be a strong risk factor. Weaker risk factors include having a prior cesarean, being younger or older, like younger than 20 or older than 35. If it's your first birth, you're at slightly higher risk for postpartum hemorrhage. If your baby's breech, and if you're giving birth preterm or postterm. So those are all things we can know ahead of time. The things we don't know until the birth is happening, the strongest risk factors are a tear in your cervix, a uterine rupture, or a retained placenta. A moderate risk factor is when the placenta separates from the uterine wall before birth. Uterine infection, giving birth with forceps or vacuum, having a third or fourth degree tear of the perineum, giving birth by cesarean is a moderate risk factor, and having a large baby that weighs more than 9 pounds, 15 ounces. And then we get down to the weaker risk factors, and that's where you have induction of labor. So all of those things that I mentioned earlier are associated with a much stronger risk of postpartum hemorrhage. And induction is considered a weaker risk factor. It's a similar risk factor to like having an epidural, having an episiotomy, having general anesthesia during the birth. So why might it increase the risk? It's thought that perhaps the uterus has been contracting for a longer time with an induction and stronger than it normally would contract. And that kind of wears the muscle down so that it can't clamp down after the birth and stop the bleeding from where the placenta comes away normally. So with an induction that goes for a really long time, an induction where your uterus is showing signs of exhaustion, that would mean you're at higher risk for postpartum hemorrhage.
Okay, yes. And then thank you for that. And then there's, what is it? It's like if you have had Pitocin during the labor, the protocol is to always have it for that third stage for the birth of the placenta, well, or during that aspect.
Well, you know, in terms of whether you have Pitocin given as well during the third stage, I wouldn't say that it's specific to whether or not you have an induction. In terms of Pitocin, I would recommend just going and reading that article because there's a lot of evidence and there's controversy over whether it should be expectant management, which is kind of like wait and watch and see if you need it, or if you just give everybody the medications. And so people who are at higher risk for postpartum hemorrhage, evidence I think is pretty clear that giving the preventative Pitocin in the third stage is helpful. If you're at low risk for postpartum hemorrhage, it's not as helpful. So again, going back to that, induction is like a weaker risk factor, but you might be more likely to see it strongly recommended in that any situation where there's a slightly higher risk.
Yeah, and then I'm seeing it too happening in the absence of induction or augmentation being used, but in that this isn't quite exactly the topic of this, but just the idea of postpartum Pitocin being used for the management of the placenta, even in spontaneous labors where there was no augmentation, it's happening in hospitals all around. It's like maybe just a.
It's because in general, that's the obstetric guidelines recommend it. So that would be called active management of the third stage. And then midwifery guidelines recommend informed consent and letting the patient choose which route they want, whether to have the Pitocin or not. So it kind of depends on where you're practicing. In some countries, you might be more likely to see the expectant management where it's kind of like a, immediate skin to skin breastfeeding to try and increase the natural oxytocin levels and then just watching really closely for signs of hemorrhage. Whereas in the United States and hospitals, which are primarily led by physicians, you see the active management.
Yeah, it's an interesting.
That's a whole huge rabbit hole to go down. I hesitate to just talk on it briefly. I would encourage people to read more because it's a very complicated subject, and I don't want to like misstate something. But just know that receiving Pitocin in labor usually means you're receiving it over a long period of time. Whereas if you're receiving it in the third stage, it's a one time. Yes. Dose. It's not like a huge, enormous amount of Pitocin. And so I don't think there should be a lot of fear associated with using it postpartum, because it's comparative to what you would get with an induction. It's not as much as an induction.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah.
It is one of those things where my brain always thinks, and I will link your article so people can read more about it and go down that rabbit hole if they wish to do that. It is one of those things where I'm just like, I wonder what we could do, maybe creating some kind of technology that senses the, you know, it's like a certain type of Chuck's pad that has a sensor for the hemorrhage so that we can have more of that expectant management. Just because I feel like there's this other bundle, like you were saying, instead of using the cascade of intervention, which I agree with you, there is a lot of fear around that term. Maybe we should just use like a bundle. There seems to be a bundle of if the providers are not as much inclined to, not that they don't respect, but if they don't really encourage or care as much about the skin to skin and the breastfeeding, because they're like, well, we're just going to manage it with medication. It's like that mindset trickles in to where then now they just don't, there's not as much encouragement maybe. So like if the baby's sitting next, but if I think maybe it would just be a slight, who knows, this is all very speculative, but I can see how these little things sometimes in the actual experience of the birth can create a different atmosphere where maybe some of these physiological norms that we have to think about, which would be part of our human species being animals, what would be our normal post-birth behaviors and what would be the potential benefits and what's happening in the brain and the bonding and all of these different things and how this is something that would be very difficult to study. I can absolutely see that. And it's like, we can't forget it just because we don't necessarily have something that shows the evidence of like why that would be good. But we do have evidence too about, you know, breastfeeding and skin to skin, but maybe it just doesn't supersede the evidence that we have on, well, we don't want somebody to bleed out. It's like, obviously we don't want somebody to bleed out, but maybe we can have both. And like, there's a marriage, there's a gray area. It's where the Venn diagram.
Right. And then there's also like, it goes back to the, you know, your values, goals, and preferences as the person giving birth. You should have the right to decide, but often it's not presented as a choice. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if that's something that's important to you, doing your research in advance and knowing, all right, in these situations, I do not want the Pitocin in the third stage, but in these situations, I do.
Yes.
So kind of being willing to change, you know what the various reasons are for needing it. And you mentioned, you know, about preparing and knowing if there's going to be obstetric emergency. Any of you who are listening who are in the healthcare field, I strongly recommend the ALSO course. It's called Advanced Life Support and Obstetrician, Advanced Life Support and Obstetrics. It's hosted by the American Academy of Family Physicians, interestingly, not OBGYNs. And my own sister is one of the instructors, and she travels around and teaching. It's typically a several-day workshop with both didactic and drills and hands-on training. And they practice estimating blood loss. They practice the drills. They practice communication. What exactly do you do each step of the way if you're worried about, you know, what are the signs that it might be about to start a hemorrhage? And so I think this is really critical because postpartum hemorrhage is one of the leading causes of maternal death around the world. And it's scary to think that there are hospitals where people might not be as well prepared to handle it if it does occur. So, you know, that could be a question you ask your provider. Have you taken advanced life support and obstetrics? I think we should be encouraging everyone to take it. It's an evidence-based training that has been shown to reduce rates of postpartum hemorrhage. So it's a cool resource for healthcare workers.
Awesome. And that will be in the show notes too for everybody to check out. And yep, add that now to your list of your interview questions when you're finding your provider. Okay. I wanted to ask you about the evidence around induction for suspected big babies, because I know this is also another hot topic item, also because it's difficult to estimate the size of a baby inside of the belly. But sometimes I think that the information is given on ultrasound. It's like, well, your baby weighs this much, as if it's just a fact. And we have this tool, we have this imaging that we're using. And so we know without a shadow of a doubt that this is the case. And women are not often told that there is a variance there, a very well-known variance of, it's almost plus or minus 2 pounds. So like, as an example, it's, or is it 1.5 pounds? It's a lot, where they say that your baby's 10 pounds or something. And it could be that your baby is 11 pounds or 9 pounds, or even maybe further in that. And I do have a situation that just occurred with a friend where during the labor, because it was an induction that was just going very slowly and they weren't exactly sure why, they did an ultrasound during labor to find out if the baby's positioning was potentially causing any, you know, stall in why she wasn't engaging the baby, which I thought was really great. You don't hear that about that often, to look at the baby. Is the baby posterior, asynclitic, what's happening? But in the ultrasound, the estimated weight was 7.5 pounds and the baby came out 10-1. And it's like, whoa. So I just wanted you to talk about too, I know that the ultrasound estimate is a piece of this, but can we talk about the evidence for postdates and what is the potential risk and benefit there?
For evidence for big babies?
Yes.
Okay. So the only way to diagnose a big baby is to weigh the newborn after birth, because as you mentioned, it's very difficult to predict a baby's birth weight. And actually, as the baby gets larger, it's more difficult to estimate their weight. And even though people say, well, ultrasounds, you know, now we have these 3D ultrasounds, everything's better, but research has not found an improvement in the estimation of the baby's actual size. And the highest quality study I've ever done on this looked at a whole bunch of ultrasound studies, and they estimated that for every 10 babies that the ultrasound predicts will be a big baby, meaning they weigh more than 8 pounds, 13 ounces, they said about five babies would weigh more than that and five babies would weigh less, and that the error rates are similar when care providers are trying to use their hands to estimate from the outside of the belly. So even though we know that there can be more difficulties and more complications with a big baby when it's being born, we have this problem where we don't know for sure if it's a really, if it's a big baby or not. The main concern is with shoulder dystocia when there's difficulty when the birth of the shoulders. This happens to around 7 to 15% of big babies. Most of these cases can be handled by care providers with no harmful consequences to the babies, but there can be permanent nerve injuries that happen in about one out of 555 babies who weigh between 8-13 and 9-15, and one out of 175 babies who weigh 9 pounds, 15 ounces or greater. And newborn death is extremely rare, but it has been reported. And the other thing to think about, though, is that shoulder dystocia can happen at any birth. Although it's more common with a big baby, it can happen with a small baby. And I mentioned the ALSO training. That is a big part of the ALSO training, is to do interprofessional drills and how to manage shoulder dystocia safely. And research has shown that when hospitals implement these actual drills where they pretend like it's happening and they have to resolve it and everybody has to communicate, that they've been able to reduce and in some hospital systems even eliminate nerve injuries from shoulder dystocia. So if everybody communicates and knows what they're doing, it is something that can be handled. What you don't want to happen is for the care provider to panic and start pulling on the head, because then the shoulders are stuck behind bone and you're like, you know, basically yanking at the nerves. So one potential solution that doctors have proposed for big babies is, well, let's just induce anyone who we think has a big baby, we'll induce them early. And you would think that would make sense because the babies would be smaller, so you'd have fewer cases of shoulder dystocia. And what the randomized trials have found on this, where they flipped a coin and some people with suspected big babies got an early induction and others did not, they found that the rates of shoulder dystocia did go down with induction from 7% to 4%, but there was no impact on nerve injuries or admissions to the neonatal intensive care unit. Induction did increase the risk of severe tears in the moms, and it increased the risk of the baby needing treatment for jaundice. And so because of this evidence not really clearly showing benefits for babies, ACOG in the U.S. does not recommend induction for big babies before 39 weeks. And then again, a 39-week induction in that kind of situation would probably fall into an elective induction category, because a big baby is not like a clear indication for an induction because we don't know if it's big or not, unless it was appearing to be very large and or there was diabetes involved, then that could be considered a medical indication. But yeah, that's a big issue. Big babies, I would say the last research we had on this was about 10 years ago. found that 1 in 3 moms in the United States was being told their baby was too big. So it was pretty common about 10 years ago. I would imagine it's still similar rates because I hear about it all the time.
Yeah, I hear about it a lot as well. And then there's just sort of this, it gets swept up, you know, the baby's born and they're like, oh, actually this baby's only 8 pounds. Okay, whatever. And then it's just kind of not talked about again because, you know, now these parents are new parents and it's just like all the hustle bustle and happy and right. joy of having a baby. But then like nobody ever kind of falls back up and says, wait a minute, but I was told but we did this. We did a cesarean, or, you know, this idea of somebody's in an induction, maybe big baby conversation's not even on the table yet. They're in an induction. It's going, it's just a little slow. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now it's like more Pitocin. Okay. Now epidural, more Pitocin, intrauterine pressure sensor. Why is this happening so slow? Failed induction, cesarean, but maybe in that in between or something, there's this conversation that's happening where the woman is told, you know, maybe this baby's just too big to fit through your pelvis. Maybe mm-hmm. this is just what's happening. And that's a common one. And maybe, you know, it's like we're trying to troubleshoot and figure it out. Nobody knows in the moment. Nobody has a crystal ball. What do we say? What do we do? But I just feel like there is then this big lack of consequence or not consequence, because it's not like they need to get reprimanded, but big lack of like follow back up on that idea. And also even just a conversation between the doctor and the woman of, hey, you know what, actually, just so you know, this baby could totally fit through your pelvis. If you have babies again in the future, mm-hmm. like it should be fine. You would be a great candidate for VBAC or whatever. We don't really know why. Sometimes babies don't, you know, we need help. Thank God we do, because there's a lot of babies that have been saved.
Right. And a lot of it is fetal positioning and, yes. you know, with inductions that can be hard because maybe baby wasn't in an ideal position to come out. And sometimes we don't know why. I was just talking with someone recently who had an induction at 42 weeks and baby was not particularly large, but her labor just completely stopped after being in labor for many, many hours. She got to 7 centimeters and just never dilated any further. And those things happen and we just can't explain them, mm-hmm. you know, and that's where you can, you know, be thankful for interventions to be able to have a baby safely when maybe 100, 200 years ago wouldn't have been the case. But we do see, I think, you know, that you have this balance of we can use interventions as tools and then we can also have overuse and harms created from overuse. So it's like finding that balance and finding, I think the most important thing is having a care provider that you trust, that you have a relationship with, so that if they say, hey, look, I think we need to do this because of XYZ, you truly trust their opinion. And that's I think, is empowering, you know, to Absolutely. Know that you have hired someone that you trust and that they have your best interests at heart. It's not because of liability or because of convenience or whatever, that they really are telling you their professional opinion and you know, you choose to go along with that, then that's a good fit between you and your provider.
Yeah. And that experience, I think, on the woman will land very differently in the immediate and in the future of her perceptions on the way the birth went. And
yeah, was, you know, she coerced into it, or yes. was it truly a decision among equals on the team?
Yeah. Yes. And like, was she respected? Was she given a chance to kind of ask questions and all of that, all of the different situations? And I've been at a birth before as acting as a doula where the OB came in and gave a very long, nice, beautiful, informed consent, the best that I've ever seen, and saying, you know, hey, we can continue with this induction. And there was Pitocin. She said, it's probably going to be another 24 to 48 hours. So if you're happy with that, I'm happy with that. We can do that. Or we can do this and we can do this. And I just loved the options because it was non-emergent. Obviously, in the situation right. of an emergency, we're not having conversations. We're trying to save lives. So I think people need to understand that too. There's so many extremes, right? Like sometimes people are very extreme in the natural world or very extreme in the conventional world. And everything, I think, like as we've been saying again and again, is some sort of a blend of in the gray, in the middle ground, mixed with the preferences and values of the patient, mixed with the reality before us. And this mm-hmm. is something I repeat again and again in my trainings, is we need to have the plan of what we wish and want, but then intersect that with the reality of what's happening before us. If there's like, you know, I don't know, extreme extremely dark, thick, sticky meconium in the water, this might pivot our plans for what's happening. And because of the risk there, like the benefits need to outweigh the risks in all of the situations that we're making. And it may not be what we want in the moment, but that I think is just something that is part of motherhood. Like you were mentioning earlier, we are out of control. We're in a dance now. It's not just about us and our individual single life that we can have more control over. We are interplaying now our lives with another human that we also love very much. And sometimes it just doesn't go exactly the way we want, or we need to lean into medicine, which I think is amazing and beautiful. And at the same time, human error with medicine, when things are, you know, providers are working these long shifts and they're seeing hundreds and hundreds of babies born every month, and it can kind of become an assembly line. And we need to keep that checked, I think. I mean, this is my opinion, right? Like, we need to keep in check that we are remembering that we are human and we are speaking to people. And, you know, the labor and delivery nurses and the OBs are wonderful people who are doing a lot of work here. And at the same time, sometimes it can just sort of be plug and play, and everybody has a bad day sometimes, or whatever can happen. And it just needs to, we need to remember that we are all important in these different ways and have an overall sense of reverence for birth. I think that's, like, you know, you and I obviously have this, we've dedicated like our whole lives to it, because birth is amazing and we want it to be something that is an empowering, beautiful experience where everybody walks away from it feeling the best that they can.
Exactly.
Okay. So I think that we are probably out of time. I would love to have you back on for some other specifics in the future, because I do want to hear about, you know, so many things. I think I could pick your brain for a million hours, as most people would say, but I really appreciate you coming on, Dr. Decker. Thank you so much for your just like unending work and what you do with providing education for parents and people in general, but then all of your other practitioner resources as well are incredible. So again, if anybody's listening to this, the show notes will be packed with different information, about your information or your, sorry, offerings, but also that, also course, the obstetric kind of like emergency one that's going to teach about hemorrhage and shoulder dystocia. And we could talk about that for a long period of time too. I mean, there's so much here, but I do want to try to keep us to an hour. So I think I appreciate your time so much, and thank you for everything you do.
Thank you so much for having me, Morgan.
Are you pregnant or trying to conceive and looking for reliable, engaging education around how to have a healthy pregnancy and prepare for the future aspects of motherhood to come, like birth, breastfeeding, and postpartum? Look, I've got you. This is exactly the education you'll receive with my 6-week pregnancy call. You get access to my most comprehensive resource of everything that I wish women knew before heading into motherhood. It's a pregnancy health course, birth prep series, breastfeeding 101 course, and postpartum planning class, all in one. And for 6 straight weeks, we meet for an hour each week on Zoom with a small group of like-minded women going through it too, for you all to ask me questions and get clarity from a trusted expert. I can walk through it with you and hold your hand. The 6-week pregnancy call is only offered 4 times a year, so get on the waitlist now. Head to milkmedicine.com for more information or click the link in the show notes. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Healthy as a Mother podcast. In order for others to hear this information, please leave a review with Apple Podcasts, subscribe, and send to a friend who could benefit from this content. We're so excited to share more on becoming and being a mother next time.
And please remember that the ideas and views of this podcast are for informational purposes only and are not intended to serve as a substitute for medical care of any kind, including the diagnosis or treatment of any illness or disease. Consult with your provider before integrating this information into your own care plan. And remember, a healthier future starts now, and it starts with you.